Welcome to the East Traumacast. This program was brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Advancing science, fostering relationships, and building careers. Now, on to the Traumacast.
Before we get started, I'd like to say thank you to Haemonetics for their generous and unrestricted grant for the Educational Resources Committee and Traumacast. I'm Lauren Dudas, acute care surgeon from West Virginia University.
Thank you, first, for this opportunity. My name is Mohammed Bawazir. I am a trauma acute care surgeon at Tufts University School of Medicine. It's an honor and a privilege to be hosting today my first Traumacast as a member of the Education Resource Committee and my favorite topic, robotics for the acute care surgeon. And we're privileged to have two pioneers who started this journey together as partners, and we're going to learn from them.
I'm Heather Evans. I am trauma acute care surgeon, elective general surgeon, critical care doc, soon to be chief of surgery at our VA here in Charleston. And it's been really very exciting and a great privilege to have the opportunity to adopt the robot as an adult.
So I'm Bruce Crooks. I'm the chief of the Division of General Surgery at the Medical University of South Carolina. I am a maximally invasive surgeon. So I do trauma surgery, emergency general surgery, surgical critical care, and elective general surgery. And I'm also the associate chief quality officer over perioperative services at the Medical University of South Carolina. And it's an absolute privilege and honor to be doing an East Traumacast. Yay.
We're glad to have you.
Thank you both for being here today. We'd like to start first by the history of the robotics and the advancement of technology as it is related to acute care surgery. What did you guys notice over the past few years? How this advancement of technology been beneficial for the acute care surgery?
So I think, Mohammed, the reason that we first got interested in it was really for our elective hernia practice, more so than anything else. I think one of the things that I began to notice is that we're in a fairly competitive market where we're the main academic medical center, but there's a large community-based healthcare system in the area, and we're direct competition with them. And one of the things I was finding is our residents were rotating with the community general surgeons and coming back and telling me how much robotic surgery they were doing. And more importantly, from my end, that they had just, one of the practices in the community had hired a minimally invasive surgeon to do robotic hernia repairs. So that was my first interest in it. I went up to one of our regional healthcare systems in South Carolina and got to watch Alfie Carbonell, who's a former president of the American Hernia Association, do some cases. And came back kind of stunned at what he was able to do, where he was doing effectively what cases which I would do open, and was doing them with the robot. So that was my initial kind of foray and interest into robotics, was mostly for elective surgery. But one of the things that happened was, as we picked this up, there were two main impetuses for us to kind of begin to apply it to acute care. One is it was very difficult for us to get time on the robot as an elective service. We were in direct competition with urology and GYN oncology for access. And one realization we had very quickly was that you need to get as many touches as you can very early on, otherwise it becomes kind of a backup tool for you. So we realized that the robot wasn't being used at all at night. And having a service where we had people in-house 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with a robot that was just unoccupied all night long, it seemed to make sense to apply it to the patient population that we were seeing. I think the other thing is, as you begin to use the robot, you start to realize the breadth of applications that it has on it, because it's taking natural hand motions that you have, the ability to supinate and pronate and on wristed instruments opens up a whole new world for you in terms of operative techniques on a minimally invasive front. And again, if you look at our patient population, the morbidity in acute care surgical patients is so high that anything you can do to cut down that morbidity through a minimally invasive approach, I think, is worth it.
Yeah, I'll just say that I was very fortunate to join the group at MUSC right as all these thoughts were going through Bruce's head. And so when I took the job, one of the carrots was, hey, you want to learn how to use the robot? And I said, oh, absolutely. And although I've been a trauma surgeon my whole career, I also really loved minimally invasive surgery. And when I was at Harborview in my first job, I started doing minimally invasive hernia repair. And I pretty much used that as my gateway to acquiring more advanced laparoscopic skills and got into more abdominal wall reconstruction while I was there as well. So when I came to MUSC and the opportunity arose to learn how to use the robot, I jumped at it. I was saying before we started recording how I feel like it's so important for all of us to stay a little hungry and every 5 years or so really push yourself in a new direction, whether that's a new skill set in the operating room or either clinical work or administrative or research wise. And this was definitely a leap for me as a, you know, starting this second phase of my career. And I really was astonished how much we were able to do and how fast you can adopt it if you are already a strong laparoscopic surgeon. I think understanding an operation in a minimally invasive perspective and then being given really fine tools to be able to execute and adapting your approach to suit the instruments, you know, that wasn't in and of itself a challenge. But I think once you get over that initial learning curve, you start to see an opportunity at every corner to be able to use this device to improve outcomes, like Bruce was saying. You know, in the beginning, I didn't imagine that I would be doing cholecystectomies with the robot. And now I feel like it's such an important tool in our toolbox. I'm certain that I could do a lot of the gallbladders that I do robotically with a laparoscope, but the degree of safety and visualization and precision that you have with the robot is really something that I think adds a degree of, I don't know, finesse to the operations that are really disastrous sometimes. I mean, I think I've done 5 gallbladders in the last 2 weeks on call. And, you know, one of them was maybe a top 3 of my career in difficulty, but I never felt unsafe. And I think that kind of security that we have and being able to really visualize and control the situation even better than you could potentially open in some regards. And I know that there are going to be a lot of people listening to this thinking that I'm crazy saying that, but you know, when the abdominal wall is 4 inches thick and the patient is not as healthy as you'd want them to be able to minimize the burden that your operation is placing on them and facilitate a faster recovery. I mean, most of these disastrous gallbladders that we do, patients can go home from the operating room, and that's really extraordinary. So, you know, there was a big push in the last couple of years to move towards fenestration of the gallbladder. And I think that there's a role for that, but there's also a role for executing a safe operation with the best tools possible. And I think that, you know, you're able to avoid doing fenestration a lot more of the time when you're using the robot.
Thank you. That was a great start. I was going to ask why an acute care surgeon or maximally invasive surgeon were trained to do big incisions. We operate on sick patients. Why should we bother going through the robot? It's a hassle to go through the learning and the training. And so probably you mentioned that because better patient care, the technology made everything easier, better imaging, ergonomics. You can suture easier. So that all benefits of the robot over laparoscopy. So for an acute care surgeon, what type of training they should go through to become a competent robotic surgeon?
So I think, you know, the first concept here, Mohammed, at least in my opinion, is you have to understand the basics of the operation to start, right? You know, how to do a good laparoscopic cholecystectomy, a laparoscopic inguinal hernia, just basic laparoscopy. Now, keep in mind where I came from, right? So I trained, I went to medical school, I hate to date myself, but from 92 to 96, and finished my, started residency in 1996, when laparoscopy had really just gotten kind of going. So a lap chole was really the only operation I was trained to do laparoscopically. I did an occasional, laparoscopic IPOM repair, but that was like a really rebellious operation back then. And then as I became I did a fellowship in maximally invasive surgery, like most of you, where all of my operations were single port sites that were 30 centimeters long, right? And then became an attending. And as I was an attending, I started to do a little bit more laparoscopy. So lap appies, I thought was the dumbest operation on the face of the earth when I was doing it, because everyone was an open appy. I started doing more and more laparoscopic hernia repairs. But so my training was not very different from any other acute care surgeon that's out there. I wasn't like some gifted minimally invasive surgeon. I think what happened for me was, as I began to adopt this, taking those basic premises from laparoscopy, they actually translate over very well over to robotics. But what the robot does, it takes my rudimentary minimally invasive skills and augments them. It makes me a better minimally invasive surgeon, quite frankly, because there are things that I can do with the robot that I would never dream of doing with a laparoscope. And in particular, the biggest one for me is intracorporeal suturing, which I always struggled with laparoscopically. I just could never get the angles right. It was like trying to sew with chopsticks, right? Just really hard. And with the robot, because it mimics your normal hand motions, it becomes much more natural and you're much more facile. As you get competent on the robot, what you begin to realize is that there's a wealth of other operations that are open up to you and things that you can do because you've developed those kind of basic skills. Now, to me, there's kind of three phases of your growth. There's case 0 to 30, which is a very steep part of the learning curve. And it's during that part where you kind of sit back and you say, boy, I could have been done with this case 20 minutes ago with a laparoscope. Things would have been really easy. And you struggle a little more than a little bit. By about case 30, I think that's where your switching costs kind of equilibrate and the light goes on. You say, holy cow, I can see where this is going to get me. And then 30 to 100, you're really building mastery. After about 100, you feel pretty, really comfortable. Your learning curve begins to really kind of flatten out, but you become much more facile. And then it becomes about reducing your times and having more economy of motion as you operate.
But from 0 to 30, what kind of cases do you do?
So I was just looking down at my Intuitive app to check and see my log of when my case time started going down. And I remember when I first started doing these cases, I pretty much did all inguinal hernias in the beginning, but I had a pretty long experience of laparoscopic TEP. And so I was converting from a TEP to a TAP, because doing TAP is actually quite easy with the robot. The closure of the peritoneal flap is really easy, like Bruce was saying, because the suturing is so much easier than it is laparoscopically. And so there's no reason to avoid that. And there are some advantages to doing TAP, which I never wanted to admit when I was a TEP surgeon. And some of them include it's easier to reduce a hernia when it's incarcerated. You get to look at the bowel if it's incarcerated or anything else that's incarcerated in the hernia, and you can evaluate it. So, there is a little bit of like struggle with, I'm a TEP surgeon, why can't I do a TEP on the robot at the beginning? I see you laughing, Bruce, because I know you felt the same way. And then you start to embrace this idea of like, wow, I can really do this operation better than I ever could laparoscopically. And there are some cases that I never would have tried laparoscopically. And I think once you get beyond about 30 cases, you're like, okay, bring it on. Give me a redo. I'll do a redo that has mesh on the inside. Give me a scrotal hernia. And maybe I'll do something that's, more complicated, like a hernia that has, incarcerated bladder or something. And I think once you get to the point where you're starting to do those more difficult cases, you really see the benefit of using the robot. I think my dissection is better now I think I understand the operation better now, because when you're driving not only the instruments of dissection, but you're also driving the camera, you know, you have full control over what you're visualizing at all times. And you're not, there's no frustration level that someone's looking at something that you don't want to be looking at. And, you know, you don't need that kind of communication with the person that you're operating with. So it ends up being like a fully immersive experience. And sometimes that's a bad thing, because you don't want to get lost in the operation. And I think people talk about that too. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, that learning curve, once you start to see the possibilities, then you start looking for opportunities to use the robot where you wouldn't have used a laparoscope in the past. And I think the biggest area for me there has been in abdominal wall reconstruction. You know, Bruce mentioned that as well. When I went to go see Alfie Carbonell in Greenville, I was amazed at it wasn't even that Alfie was doing the operation. His fellow was doing it, and yeah, they were doing things that I couldn't have even imagined, you know, closing fascia and placing these gigantic pieces of mesh in a retrorectus fashion. And then, you know, fast forward to a couple of years later, and now we're doing these operations at MUSC. The training to get to that point, I think it has been really well designed by the company. And I think that they have a particular facility with working with adult learners and acknowledging what your experience is to that point. I mean, there's some rules about how many cases that you have to have done before you can take the advanced hernia course, for example. And I think that's really a very well thought out curriculum and requirements for adopting the new skills, because, you know, there is some responsibility here. These are not easy cases. The first big abdominal wall reconstruction I did took me many more hours than I'm willing to admit. But I think, you know, you make some choices about patient selection and you refine who really is going to benefit from these cases. You can take somebody that has a pretty big incisional hernia that would require an admission and make it either a 23-hour stay or a same-day surgery. And I think that's really the ultimate, is getting to the point where you're able to do operations that convert from an inpatient to an outpatient operation. I'm not saying that patients won't have some post-operative recovery pain, and, you know, it doesn't change the recovery that much, but it does facilitate just a more manageable recovery for patients, particularly if, you know, you're dealing with a patient that has not so big of a hernia that you're going to have a lot of extra tissue in the skin and subcutaneous area. Those hernias probably still should be repaired open or in a hybrid fashion because of how much tissue disruption there is. I think there still is a role for open surgery. I don't think that we're ever going to completely replace the open surgeon. And that may be controversial to say with, you know, the minimally invasive surgeons in the crowd, but I think, you know, maximally invasive surgeons that can do minimally invasive surgery are kind of the Swiss Army knife of the hospital now.
I think in this crowd, you're going to mostly find maximally invasive. So you won't be insulting anyone with that comment. Yeah. Bruce, integrating laparoscopy into emergency general surgery, do you think that the obstacles with integrating robotics into an emergency general surgery practice are larger, or are those that haven't adopted just having this perceived like giant hurdle to overcome?
So I think they're definitely bigger, but I think a lot of that is the perceptions that have been set up around robotics, right? So most hospitals, you have a couple of issues there. One is when the robot kind of rolled out, it was really rolled out for urologists, in particular for prostatectomies and for GYN oncologists and benign gynecologists, so that they got very facile on it. And what happened was, in a lot of hospitals, you set up robotics teams for the operating room because the robot was this big, scary thing that only specialized people could touch and get used to. That has put up a psychological and inherent kind of logistical barrier to groups like us just jumping on the robot and using it, quite frankly, particularly using it after hours. So one thing you won't need to do is when you're fighting to get access, in particular after hours access, is to burst or break that myth away. So when we first got this up and running, you know, our first observation was getting elective time on the robot was very difficult because we were competing with groups that had already well established themselves, in particular urology and gynecology, and we got kind of trace access to start. And when we started to think about the fact that, you know, after hours, you can shoot a cannonball through our operating rooms and not hit a urologist or a GYN oncologist after hours, and the robots are sitting by themselves, you say, well, why aren't we using this very expensive sunk cost or resource to benefit more patients? So in my case, what I did was I thought that by using it after hours, it would give me A, more cases and more touches, but B, more importantly, I can use it as a lever to go back to my operating room committee and say, hey, listen, I need more robot access because I am using it. So I went to our robot committee and said, hey, I want to do cases after hours. And they said, you're friggin' nuts. Forget it. There's no way. And I waited a month, went back again, said, I want to use it after hours. And they said, no, you're nuts. You can't. So ultimately what I did was I went and I sat down with my CEO and I said, listen, you know, you have a robot that's just sitting there after hours that hasn't been used. It's a sunk cost. You've already paid for it. You want to use this sunk cost as much as you can. And we were also talking about getting another robot on a per click model. And I said, you know, to my CEO, I can use it after hours easily because I'm not competing with anybody else. I can probably get more patients out of the hospital faster if I can do more minimally invasive operations. I can get them out more quickly if you're giving me after hours access because I can discharge them almost immediately afterwards. And by the way, there might be some quality side effects, fewer wound infections, less conversion to open operations. And he said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. You can use a robot after hours. So I then went back to the robot committee and said, hey, you know, dad in the corner office says I can use it after hours. You have to let me use it. And what we did was we developed a paradigm where we said, I don't want to have a robot team on call for me at night. What I want to do is take my normal OR people, my normal night team, the nurses that do orthopedics, spine, eyeballs, trauma cases, and I want to teach them how to use the robot. So we got together with our company rep. We trained everybody. And then my rep put himself on call with us for the first couple of nights in conjunction with the robot trained surgeons. So whenever we had a case we wanted to do on the robot, we would call our rep up, say, hey, we want to do a robot case. He would come in, help the staff get everything set up, stay for the whole case, answer questions, and then we did a post-case debrief. And pretty quickly, the barrier there, the kind of psychological barrier, broke down very quickly. And the robot became the default case, the default way of us doing things after hours. We didn't get into any arguments about whether we should be doing it with a robot or a laparoscope. The result of that is, you know, initially about 40% of my cases were done after hours, nights, holidays, and weekends. I think Dr. Evans, Heather, was doing about 23% of her cases after hours. But more importantly, what happened was after we got this up and running, other services began to realize they could do things after hours on the robot. So my thoracic surgeons, my bariatric surgeons, my colorectal guys started doing cases after hours on the robot. So for us getting the program up and running, we had a halo effect on the institution where suddenly the robot became a de facto way of doing things after hours. And the result now is that we got more block time on the robot. We now have about 20 days worth of access to it a month. And we are the busiest robot service in the Department of Surgery by far, with essentially an exponential growth curve in terms of the number of cases we've been doing. So we've been very fortunate. It's worked out really well for us and been really beneficial, I think, for our patients. And in terms of our overall morbidity, I think we're going to be seeing some benefits there.
Fantastic. Now, if you have 24-hour access for the robot, that's fantastic. You kind of talked about how you build a program and going through the administration. If you can tell us more about the role of the steering committee, now they're supporting. From the beginning, they were against, but now, what is the role of the steering committee now?
So, you know, we have a pretty robust robotic steering committee, and it's any service line that's using the robots involved in our steering committee. And monthly, we look at utilization rates, we look at robot times, and we try to tweak it and adjust it as to who needs more time and more access. I think what's happened is we went from a very peripheral player at that table to one of the more dominant players at the table, to be honest with you. We fought for more access. We've been able to get more access. And more importantly, we've been able to prove that the utilization is there for our group. I think the most important thing, or the, you know, the thing that's opening some eyes, is the amount of use that we have. If you look at the robot right now, 25% of the robot cases being done at MUSC are being done by one of our surgeons in our group. I mean, we become the dominant service on the robot. And what that's done for me is, actually, administratively, it's given me a lever to go back to the C-suite. And now what the C-suite is considering is essentially getting a robot just for our service line. And what I would like to do, ideally, is I want to provide my patients with the right operation through the right method, be it open, robotic, laparoscopic, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365. And that means continuous robot access. So the vision that we have here is, in our operating room that we have on a daily basis, we have a robot in the room. If I need to do a case open, I do a case open. If the next case is best served robotically, we do it with the robot. If you know, the third case needs to be a LAP-APP or whatever, we're able to do with the laparoscope. But adjusting and being agile and providing the patient with the right operation through the right tool is what we're really looking for. It's nonsensical to me from a quality perspective if 9 to 5, I say the best operation for you is a robotic incarcerating inguinal hernia repair. But at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I can't offer the patient that operation. It's nonsensical. And quite frankly, it chafes at all of us morally, ethically, and as surgeons, right? You want to give the patient the best chance for the best possible outcome. And that means that you have to have access to those tools 24/7. And we have to design services to maintain that quality.
I 100% agree with that. I think that, you know, the disparity between what we're able to deliver to someone who uses the emergency department as their primary contact with healthcare versus somebody who's coming in through the clinic and has a referral from, you know, their private practice family doc. I think that the difference in those two scenarios should not be access. The difference in those two scenarios may be acuity or severity of illness. And if you think about it, if someone is sicker and has a more challenging problem, you want to give them the most sophisticated approach, not the lowest common denominator. You know, I think there are consequences to saying, oh, I can't do this with the robot after hours. And on the flip side, I would say, you know, there are a lot of emergency general surgery cases that are simple and straightforward. And you might say, well, why in the world would you use the robot for such an easy case? And, you know, the residents know that when I'm on call, if someone comes in with appendicitis, we're going to do it robotically, no matter what the severity of the appendicitis is. And the reason I do that is because they need to learn how to do the operation. They need to learn how to set it up. They need to learn that there are different strategies to be able to facilitate exposure. And you can use three arms, you can use four arms. How do you do that? You can't do that in the hardest case possible the first time and learn all that you need to learn about that operation. And so I routinely will do robotic appendectomy, and I will tell you that I figured out how to do a robotic appendectomy using YouTube because I didn't want to use the stapler. I wanted to make the operation about equivalent to a LAP-APP that you would do with a stapler. And so the cost is about the same. And I tie off the appendix with a length of zero silk. And I dunk the stump just like I would do it open. And that operation for the residents is a really good experience because they learn how to control hemorrhage with bipolar cautery. They learn how to dissect around the bowel. They learn how to tie something off with a suture that is an important structure and you don't want it to leak. And they learn how to suture on the bowel. And all of those skills are pretty simple, straightforward in a simple appendicitis. And so it's a really good experience for them to apply all those different techniques so that when you're faced with somebody that has recurrent appendicitis or perforated appendicitis and everything is stuck and everything looks terrible, you know, you at least know how to do all of those basic maneuvers. And then the more difficult part is actually doing a safe dissection. You know, doing straightforward cases on the robot is not a waste of time or money. That is a way to gain skills and gain exposure and to train people to be able to do much more difficult and sophisticated operations.
Totally agree. Yeah.
So do you have any physiologic limits for a patient? You'll say, no, this patient, we're not going to go to the robot. We're just going to do it in a potentially more expeditious manner.
I'm not doing a exploratory laparotomy for an unstable hypotensive trauma patient on the robot.
No, but I'm saying like a, you know, an incarcerated hernia with, you know, you suspect it might be strangulated with dead bowel, that kind of patient, are you still bringing them to the operating room for the robot?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the tricks here, right, is realize that if you're looking at, if you're putting your quality hat on, right, about, you know, 11% of surgical admissions are emergency general surgery. And you and I all both, we all both know that none of those patients have had the benefit of any prehabilitation. And they all come in with some degree of physiologic disruption, right? And the result of that is about 50% of emergency general surgery patients will wind up having complications or some increase in their morbidity. So if you look at that, if you're trying to think of quality initiatives to decrease morbidity in surgical patients in particular, emergency general surgery is like the place to start, right? We're trouble for any hospital quality department. So if you can keep operations minimally invasive, minimize your incisions, get the patients out of the hospital faster, mobilize them more quickly, and expand the repertoire of things you can do through a minimally invasive fashion, you got to do it. I mean, you just have to do it. And the reality is for me, the robot makes me a better minimally invasive surgeon. It opens up the number of things I can do. So some of them, you know, and Heather and I have had this discussion, you know, like the classic one for me is I have a couple, you know, halo cases I think about, but the classic one for me is the PEG tube that falls out in the middle of the night, right? We've all been on call. You know, the PEG tube that our partner put in 2 days ago has been pulled out by the patient. And now effectively you have, you know, a gastric ulcer that's perforated, right? So for me, in my previous hands, that used to be an upper midline incision, you know, bring the stomach up, put a new tube in it, stam it up there, close the defect. And then about 6 months later, I'm fixing the incisional hernia that they all got, right? And in a lousy spot, that epigastric hernia is a nightmare. For me now, that operation is 3 8-millimeter ports down low, right? I put a new tube in through the stomach wall. I stam the stomach up to the interabdominal wall with the robot, sew it up, wash them out, and then pull out my ports. And I don't have to worry about the epigastric hernia. And those patients do great. They really do really well. You know, I had another one, you know, my other halo case was I had a patient that came in after we got this started. It was a stab wound to the abdomen. Guy had a omentum eviscerated out through a stab wound and he was hemodynamically stable, no peritonitis. And I was looking at the guy, I'm like, well, I have a choice. I have to lap him, right? And I'm thinking to myself, he's going to get a full-on laparotomy. And I was like, well, wait a minute, let me do it with the robot. 3 8-millimeter incisions, reduced the omentum, sewed the defect closed, ran his bowel, proved he had no injuries and sent him home from the recovery room. No follow-up visit or video visit follow-up with me. That's an example of someone where I saved the hospital 3 days of you know, essentially an inpatient stay for a guy. That guy got back to work within 2 weeks and wasn't out for 6 weeks to heal his laparotomy incision. no morbidity for him. Now, that's a cherry-picked case. I'll be the first one to admit it. But if you look at that, you say to yourself, did the robot offer value to that patient and value to my hospital? And the answer there for me is a clear 100% yes. And that's a tool I never would have had unless we had gone down this pathway.
That's great. So let's talk about the cost. Most surgeons who are concerned about going through the training and adopting the technology about the cost issue. And so how did you overcome the cost issues at your hospital? Did you think it's different? Is it really significantly higher or cheaper?
I'll just say that I think in the end, you know, the goal here is to reduce length of stay. And if you can convert an operation from a several day stay in the hospital to going home from the PACU or even a 23 hour stay, you're revolutionizing your service line. There's no question that the equipment is more expensive. There's no question that if, you know, you open the stapler, the suction irrigator, and an advanced energy device, you are now committing a lot of money to that operation. But you don't have to use all of those instruments in most of the cases that we do. And, you know, if you look online, there are a number of surgeons that have articulated minimal instrument packs for cholecystectomy, appendectomy, you know, these common cases that we're doing. And you can approach the cost of a laparoscopic case. You know, you're never going to compare buying the robot to, you know, buying your laparoscopic tower. But, you know, the per case cost, not including all of those fixed costs, approaches the same depending upon, you know, how you strategize your instrumentation. You know, the ports are reusable. The instruments are not thrown away after every case. They're reprocessed. You know, Bruce, I'm sure you have a lot more detail about this, but I think that those are the concepts that the ACS surgeon should understand. And you know, like the other night, the difference between one cholecystectomy to another on call, one we were able to do without even using a suction irrigator at all. Another, I opened the laparoscopic suction irrigator because it's so much less expensive than the robotic one. And you can just suck things out at the very end of the case when you're undocked. But there was a third case that was really, really challenging. And using the suction irrigator was part of my dissection. And the suction irrigator for the robot is an extraordinary instrument. I mean, you can like crush all the stones that are impacted in somebody's horrible cholecystitis gallbladder and aspirate all of them through the suction irrigator. And you can't tell me that doesn't save time and morbidity to the patient if you're not pulling those out through a big incision that you've made at the end of the case. So, I mean, there are trade-offs here.
Yeah, so I agree. I think it's going to be really interesting as we begin to look at this and we do more and more cases, Mohammed. The trick here is if you're a hospital administrator, right, you know that there are two ways to increase, you know, your profit margin at your hospital. One is to decrease costs and the other one is to increase volume, right? So if I'm a CEO of a healthcare system, most of the time, what I've already done is I've already pared down my costs pretty dramatically. I've cut, you know, I've made had negotiations with my major suppliers and cut down my supply costs as much as possible. So most of them, their biggest goal is to decrease or increase volume. The way that you increase volume on the inpatient side is by decreasing length of stay as much as possible. On two premises. One is patients with complications don't stay for shorter lengths of time, right? The minute you get a complication in a patient, you're buying the patient more inpatient days and more costs. The second component to that is if I can get people out more quickly and reduce my length of stay on an observed to expected ratio of less than one, I've actually flipped the tables at my restaurant. What I mean by that is you look at a restaurant, their goal is to get you in the door, you order your appetizer, get your drink, you eat your dinner, you get out the door as fast as you can so you can get another, you know, customer at that table. Hospitals operate in the same way. If I can avoid an open cholecystectomy in somebody, in a patient, I've opened up 3 days' length of stay. And that's a big deal for a hospital administrator, because in theory, you can fill that patient, that bed, three times over, right? So the best example is the one I just gave you, which was a stab wound patient. By saving a three-day length of stay in that patient and discharging him from the recovery room, my hospital actually filled that bed a couple times over and gained increasing amounts of profit for each day. So what's really interesting to me is going to be the downstream economic analysis and a lot of that. While the upfront cost may be a little higher with the robot, what's really interesting to me is the cost avoidance of the complications and the cost avoidance of the increased length of stay that comes with a conversion to an open operation. And I think as a community, we're going to have to start looking at that and being conscientious about that and including that in our economic and financial analysis of the implications of this. What's happened for me personally, and I'm sure Dr. You know, Heather's had the same experience, is the number of cases that I'm able to avoid an open operation in has begun to skyrocket. And, you know, the other weekend I was on, I got a robot flip room, quite frankly. So I just flip patients from room to room. I did 8 robot cases on a weekend. You can't tell me that that didn't have an advantage for patients in terms of the length of stay in avoiding the open operation. I think we're going to see that more and more. And it's anecdotal at the moment, but I think it's going to come.
I'd also say that in terms of, you know, your marketability and your draw for patients, you know, people are going to want to come to your medical center if they know that they're not going to get a big incision. I mean, that's just the way that the market rolls. And I don't think that it's crazy to imagine that people would choose where to go for an emergency either. I mean, I just don't think that that's a crazy idea. The consumer is smarter than you think. And, you know, if you want to be busy, you have to be competitive. You know, I would also say, like, in terms of standardization, I have gotten it down to, I can reliably tell my inguinal hernia patients, you're going to have 3 days of pain. I'm not going to give you narcotics. I'm going to see you back in 2 weeks. And I almost guarantee you by day 4, you're going to be back to your usual level of activity. And that's been like pretty consistent over the last 5 years. I can see when I came to MUSC, I just stopped prescribing oxycodone for those operations. And I think, you know, to be able to have consistency of outcomes, precise dissection, getting closer and closer to having the kind of pain control or pain avoidance at the time of surgery, like you can expand that to beyond elective surgery. You know, I do a lot of tap blocks on my patients. When I do bilateral inguinal hernia, I do an ilioinguinal nerve block with laparoscopic guidance. And I think it has made a tremendous difference in the post-op recovery of my patients. But you can do the same thing with all of your robotic surgery. And one of the community hospitals that we actually did quite a few of our initial cases at, the anesthesiologists do a tap block on every single patient. But you don't have to rely on the anesthesiologist to do that. You know, the visualization is so good with most laparoscopic systems now too. You know, you can really have a higher degree of pain control than we ever have before. And so if you're adding minimally invasive surgery, preemptive analgesia, and a consistency of dissection, you can have much more consistent outcomes and better quality in the long run.
Tell us a little bit how, you know, our responsibility as educators at academic institutions is also to keep our residents and fellows involved in these cases. What have you done to prepare them to be ready to stay involved in all these ACS cases?
Oh, well, they're on call with us and they are along for the ride. I mean, I think that I've talked to some of our more senior residents about this because they've watched us adopt robotics. And I think there really is something to seeing your faculty learn something new. It's frustrating in some ways because we do more than maybe we would have if it were a different kind of case. But I think it's also really important for them to see us adopt a new technique and to hear us thinking out loud and discussing. I think we spend a lot more time talking about indications and challenges and what we did really well or what we did maybe we have areas for improvement after the cases. And I think that openness and that willingness to be humble and learn something new along with your residents is a really, really wonderful opportunity. So I would really encourage any acute care surgeon to not feel like this is a problem for your residents. This is an opportunity for them to see you grow in a new way.
So they're bedside assisting, or you have a dual console, or they're on the console, or how are they?
We have dual console, and they do both. When they're junior and when they haven't had very many robotic cases, they bedside assist most of the time, and sometimes we'll have them jump back in a case where things are getting more complicated and we need to have a higher degree of reliability of instrument exchange or having a bedside assistant. But I will tell you that our residents get a lot of robotic exposure. And I was speaking with some folks at Sages, and there is actually concern now that the residents in general are not getting enough laparoscopic time. And so that is something that we definitely need to think about as educators, is that, you know, we are fortunate in that we went through a time when we did open, laparoscopic, and now robotic surgery. But we can't lose sight of the fact that there is an application for all of those things, and we have to maintain our skills.
Yeah, I think as a surgical educator, I think I would say that the robot for me has been the safest teaching platform I've come across for a couple different reasons. One is, on a dual console system, you can give the resident the controls and take them back almost at will. So the worst case for me used to be a July lap Coley with a PGY2. It's a horrible case. You can't really, it's hard to teach. It's hard to point at what structures you want dissected. And the minute you say, hey, let me show you how this is done for a second, and you walk to the other side of the table, both you and the resident know you're not walking back to the other side and you're doing the rest of the case. There's no question. With a robot, you can flip back and forth. And if you don't like what the resident's doing, you can take the controls away from them, show them gently what to do, and go back. The other beautiful thing about the system is that the My Intuitive app in particular gives you objective data about how long you're using the instruments, how long the case took, what percentage of the case you've done. And that really gives residents a sense of confidence when they see that they've gone from doing 5 minutes of the case to you doing 5 minutes of the case and they do the majority. And my chief resident the other day pointed out, he and I operated, we did 4 cases on a Friday, all on the robot. And he pointed out that I literally operated for about 12 minutes during the course of the day, right? And he did the majority of the cases. And for him, that was a huge confidence booster. He came out, came out incredibly comfortable with everything and could objectively see that he had improved over the space of his time on the service. And his confidence soared. And I think that's a huge win on the platform. You know, instead of sitting back and telling a resident, hey, you did a good job there, they can actually look at the data and use that to make judgments and adjustments in how they do cases. I think it's really spectacular way to educate.
You know, I feel like it's a win when I see that the resident has operated more than 50% of the time. You know, that's really a nice way to gauge that you're really working together and allowing that person to hone their own skills and not just, you know, showing them how to do the case. And I think that, you know, the future of this is really exciting because there's a lot of data that the platform collects that we don't have access to in that app. There is some data out there that demonstrates that the kind of movements that you make are associated with the outcomes that you have. And I think that seeing that kind of progression and watching someone become more sophisticated in their even small movements and their facility with the instruments is going to be really, really interesting.
Fantastic. I have a few cases that I would like to see how you're going to approach them in the next 5 or 7 minutes. So the first one, so you're going to tell me whether you're going to approach it open, laparoscopically, or robotically. 45 years old female, so the two-day history of right upper quadrant pain, which is tenderness in the right upper quadrant, positive Murphy's, ultrasound showed acute cholecystitis. Open, laparoscopically, robotically.
Robot.
Yeah, I mean, if I have access to the robot, I'm going to do it robotically.
Excellent. Next one, 26 years old male patient. CT scan showing acute appendicitis, non-perforated.
Outstanding case for a resident to learn some robotic skills. Yes.
Bruce,
robot.
So now for a gallbladder's appies, you always approach them robotically? Well, it depends.
So it depends. One thing I don't want to do is if, to be honest with you, if it's the simple appendectomy like you talked about, if the robot is not available to me, so it's middle of the day, peak operating room hours, Heather's on the robot already, and they say, hey, I can get you in a room with a laparoscope,
yeah,
I would probably do it laparoscopically. You know, I don't want to delay patient's care for preference for the robot. On the other hand, if you change that case around a little bit and you say acute appendicitis in a patient with a history of a kidney pancreas transplant, true, happened to me, there's no way I'm doing that with a laparoscope. That's a robot case all the way. So up the ante, make it a little bit more difficult. Then I'm holding out and waiting for the robot to be available.
Well, and I would say, like, even the case scenario where you don't have comorbidities, but you have like recurrent appendicitis with a fecalith at the base, and evidence of perforation, you better believe that I did that one robotically. And I had to suture the cecum to be able to make sure that my stump was secured. But I was very confident that it was not going to leak because I know I can do that case. Otherwise, that guy would have had a partial cecectomy, you know, with a stapler across it. So, and I'm not saying that that's a bad operation, but what's the best operation for that patient? And, you know, can that guy went home. He went home with a drain in. And I saw him back in clinic and he's doing fine.
Very good. Excellent. Next case, 50 years old male patient with an incarcerated right inguinal hernia.
Robot.
That one's easy.
Slam
dunk. Awesome case.
It's going to get more difficult. Trust me. The same 50 years old patient coming in with a strangulated ventral hernia this time.
Is it incisional or is it epigastric or is it
umbilical hernia?
I would probably give that a shot robotically.
Yep. I do it robot with Firefly. And I would look, I'd give them some ICG and see if the bowel was viable after I reduce it.
Excellent. So what cases or hernia cases that you would do open and not try them robotically?
Oh, I mean, if somebody has a perforated viscus and it's clear that they have an infection and it's involved in a hernia, or if this is a patient that has had multiple operations before, I don't feel like I need to be a hero and I'm not going to do something just because I can. I think you need to pick the best operation for the patient. And the more complex the hernia gets, the more apt I am to do it open.
Excellent.
Yeah, I agree with Heather on that one. The other one that scares me a lot are when people have bowel that's herniated over previously placed mesh. So that the abdominal wall side of the mesh is exposed to the bowel. And I really think the bowel is going to be stuck to that. There's no way I'm doing that one with the robot.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any real advantage when you're combining an infection with a prosthetic and an incarcerated segment of bowel. Like that, to me, that's going to be a complication no matter what you do. And so the best thing there is to clear out as much of the infection as possible. And I don't think anything beats doing that open.
23 years old male patient with a stab wound to the left flank. CT scan of the chest. So the small pneumothorax and the CT scan of the abdomen showed a tiny bit of free fluid in the abdomen. His hemodynamic is stable. You're really worried about a diaphragmatic injury.
We already know their answer to this one.
Well, I have to say, I haven't done it But I think that would be very reasonable. I'll take that back. I fixed a complication where there was a chest tube that went through the diaphragm and into the stomach. And I did that robotically, and it was very easy. And it would have been a big incision. It would have been hard to get back there because it was pretty posterior. You know, what you can see with that robotic scope is pretty remarkable.
That was an awesome case that took care of a very bad complication in a really nice, elegant way. To me, the answer to that, to the scenario given me, is robot as long as the patient doesn't have peritonitis. Peritonitis, you know, that for me is an open operation. But, you know, a little bit of fluid, no peritonitis, suspicion of a diaphragm injury, robot. You know, I'll give you the same scenario, bladder injury. If I think it's an isolated intraperitoneal bladder rupture, I would do that with a robot in a second.
So you're comfortable exploring the abdomen, running the bowel, looking at the stomach, rule out any other injuries, and fix the diaphragm all in the same operation?
Yes.
Good. Excellent. Last case. 18 years old. He was sitting post-MVC. He's 5 days in the ICU already. He came in 5 days ago with blunt abdominal trauma, had a splenic blush, had an angioembolization, and unfortunately now he started to bleed again. And he's probably bleeding from the spleen, post-embolization. He's 5 days in the ICU. Open laparoscopically or robotically?
Is he stable, you said?
Well, the anesthetist, good question. So the anesthetist still in
use. I see you in the ICU.
Because he had a splenic trauma and he's not intubated, the anesthetist tells you that he is volume responsive. So if you tell me,
I would probably do the laparotomy on that guy.
Laparotomy? Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, so the interesting one for me, and the reason I giggle at this a little bit, is so we have a very large sickle cell population down in South Carolina. So we get a fair number of patients with splenomegaly from their sickle cell that where I'll take out their spleens with the robot. And for me, that's a really elegant case where what we do is bring them in day before, we do a proximal splenic embolization and then a robotic splenectomy. And that case works really well for those patients, mostly because we can minimize their blood loss. They've got tons of antibodies, but also because those patients tend to have a lot of chronic pain. So a minimally invasive operation for them is fantastic. Now, if you flip the scenario around just a little bit that you're giving me and make it a little bit harder and say, well, you could proximally embolize him. And then, by the way, this guy's morbidly obese, you know, like say BMI of a gazillion, right? One of the beautiful things about the robot is it doesn't know BMI. And that may be one that I would chase after with it if you really want to get really crazy. But the scenario you gave me, I'd have to say, you know, old-fashioned open splenectomy, which is one of the operations that we went into trauma for the first place. So good times.
Excellent. Thank you so much. That was great.
This has been really thought-provoking and a really fun trauma cast.
Come visit us in South Carolina. We'll show you how it's done.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Come on. Yeah, we'll have some fun.
But thank you all for joining us. For our listeners, if you haven't had an opportunity, please check out some of the other educational resource listings on our website and the CareerCast and some of the other offerings East has. And thanks again, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Our pleasure. Had fun. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
That wraps up another episode of TraumaCast, brought to you by the Educational Resources Committee of the Eastern Association for the Surgery of Trauma. Visit east.org to check out all the great educational and career development resources we have to offer, and make sure you subscribe to the TraumaCast series so you don't miss any of our exciting upcoming programs or interviews. If you're searching for cutting-edge science, professional education, networking, and career development, remember, all you need to do is look to the east.